Hi, this is Mike McNamara, and you're listening to All Marine Radio on your home for it, the one and only All Warrior Radio Network.
We're taping this on Saturday afternoon, Sunday morning where Grant is in Australia, but Saturday afternoon, Pacific time. And so by the time you hear this, you're going to know who won the American League Championship Series, but we don't know right now. Grant's a baseball fan. I am one, too. So Grant Newsham joins us from Sydney, Australia. Grant, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks.
How did you become a baseball fan?
Well, back when I was little, there was nothing else. Nobody played, you know, football wasn't much, and basketball was nothing much, and, you know, hockey, fortunately, it's still nothing much, but it was even less back then, and it was really all there was. And I think everybody, when they were little, played baseball, and, you know, therefore, you're kind of a baseball fan. It's not like my world ends if my team doesn't win. And when you're a Senators fan, you get used to being a loser throughout life. So that has actually helped me deal with the inevitable setbacks
that life offers you being a Senator fan. What so you have to be not even cautiously pessimistic anymore. We have to be beyond that relative to the hometown team. So did you grow up in D.C.?
I lived there long enough. You know, people, I'm from, not D.C., Virginia. That's when people ask me, that's what I'll say I'm from there, though I haven't lived there for half a century.
Well, but how did you not, I mean, the Orioles, when you were a kid, the Orioles, they were a great baseball team. How did you become a Senators fan, for God's sakes?
Geographic proximity.
Oh, there you go.
You know, plus, it's Baltimore, for goodness sake.
I know. It's a dump. It's a straight-up dump.
But boy, they used to take the Senators' lunch money and stuff their head in the toilet every time they played.
They were good.
I'm enjoying the Orioles' great success in recent years.
Yeah, extended great success in recent years. So they're paying for all that which they did to you as a child. That seems to be appropriate.
That's right. So I have a can of Schadenfreude every time the Orioles lose.
Be careful with a drinking habit like that because they lose a lot. Speaking of sports, the world, or a lot of Americans who don't pay attention to China, got introduced to China via the National Basketball Association. That's been a pretty interesting little thing to watch, yes?
It certainly has. It's no surprise, actually. But
right.
Once again, it shows that... How Westerners will contort themselves into a pretzel when they smell money. And you're seeing that with the NBA stars and even the commissioner, who's trying to backpedal, though. You know, they know they can think they can make money from China. And as a result, they are groveling, kowtowing, use your word, and just an absolute embarrassment to free people anywhere. You know, I don't know of a nice way to put it, but
did you chuckle though when you saw them trying to do kind of the press conference Watusi? Let me restate that. Let me clarify my tweet. That's not what I'm saying. I mean, because this is an epiphany that they did what? And then, you know, since they've been back, the commissioner of the NBA said, yeah, the Chinese wanted me to fire that guy. He's like, what? And so, but I mean, for those of us who you have educated on and we've watched this, to me it wasn't moderately amusing. It was extremely amusing to watch and to see what the NBA would do. Would they shut up in color? Which is, right, the economic tradition that China looks for.
That's pretty much what they've done. You're right. You do kind of enjoy seeing people squirm. Like this, and you kind of enjoy seeing them torture Mr. Shakespeare's language with any possible clear meaning. Because they've gotten themselves in such a fix that you can't get out of it. Either you grovel to dictators and people like the Chinese Communist Party, or you don't. You're either free or you're not. And, you know, it's fun to see them have to deal with this issue. they're very clear about the when they protest the perceived inequities in the U.S. society, but something like China that has concentration camps that the Germans would have appreciated, that makes people disappear into black jails, black prisons. No problem there, of course. And one, the hypocrisy is really what one enjoys seeing on display. But it is about that bad, and it's really kind of funny to watch. But at the same time, it's also a clear demonstration of what the free world is up against.
You know, having staying mute all week was the grand athletic company of, you know, the great stand up for what you believe company of Nike, right? And I had gotten amused by this, right? You know, moral courage, right? It's fine until you get to the steps of my bank. And then we don't do that anymore. And so I went looking for a picture of, you know, where's Colin Kaepernick and all this, you know, the social warrior for freedom. And, you know, and I went looking and I saw his picture, right, with the Nike slogan, right? Stand for something, even if it costs you everything. Now, I don't know that that's an accurate description of what Colin Kaepernick did because his skills were declining. But anyway, let's just say it's true. Stand for something, even if it costs you anything. Nike stayed silent. They have yet to make a statement. And it's all, I mean, it's absolutely stunning. But as you said, the dollars, right, that can be taken out of China, right, will cause these people who don't shy away from criticizing anything American, right, to shut up and color in, you know, when their money's at risk in China. And it was really, it's really been something to watch. And the backlash, it'll be interesting to see what happens around the NBA as guys like LeBron James, who's taken a brunt of it for his Watusi that he tried to do, saying, yeah, Morley just needs to be more aware. Well, wait a minute. What about what they're doing to people, though? You know, I don't know anything about that. I don't have a comment on that. I don't want to talk about that. You know, oh, but you want him to shut up, right? And so it's been, I agree with you. It's been very, very interesting, and I owe you for certainly educating us along those lines. You know, we had a big discussion last week on the program. Colonel Jeff Kenney and Tim Lynch and I, who all taught at about the same time at IOC or shortly thereafter, and we've been friends for a long time, and so they come on, and we kind of chew the fat on different issues. And one of the issues that somebody had brought up to us was, can the United States afford a Marine Corps that's so nuanced to a confrontation with China that it stops being a generalist, which the nation tends to need on more occasion than it needs the specific force, if you look at history? I'd be curious about your thoughts. The Marine Corps going, quote-unquote, all in to the Pacific, giving up tanks, giving up tubed artillery, things that tend to work pretty well when you're in a pinch and becoming something else. One, I want your thoughts on that. Two, do you believe that Congress of the United States, when they look at the whole picture, will look at the Marine Corps and say, you know what, we appreciate your enthusiasm and the sentiment, but we can't afford you to be that specialized. So your thoughts on those two things.
I've heard that the arguments, or the not arguments, the ideas that we may be now putting all our eggs into the Asia basket rather than being a force that fights in any clime and place.
Right.
And there is something to that. You know, I've always thought that the Marines should be able to fight anywhere and should be ready to do that as well. And I don't know why they can't. It seems, for whatever reason, that we sort of institutionally tend to go to the next hot thing, whatever that is, and everything is, wherever the action is. And you notice that with the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and the Middle East, that suddenly, when that became the hot thing, everybody rushed there and it wanted to get there. And it was amazing, actually, how many people had always been really interested in counterinsurgency and insurgencies you know, once those wars started, all the you know, the people who saw which way the wind was blowing suddenly got counterinsurgency religion. Whereas the people who had been thinking about that for many years, they all got sidelined. But everyone was the counterinsurgency. You know, they put out a new manual, which isn't even as good, which isn't nearly as good, actually, as the Small Wars Manual the Marines had done in the 20s. But now that the hot thing is Asia, one can imagine there's going to be all sorts of Asia experts coming out of the woodwork once again, and everyone's going to want a piece of that action. And then it'll shift somewhere else. You know, once the war starts in the Arctic, you can expect there'll be lots of, you know, people who've, you know, discovered Eskimo ancestry. But we tend to go too far in whatever direction. And with the Commandant's recent guidance saying that Asia will have priority, you know, I wish it's good. I think it's a good thing. But it would be good if he could somehow get across that it doesn't mean priority doesn't mean ignoring everything else, and the way that it did for those 20 years in the so-called sandbox, where nobody was interested in Asia in the Marine Corps. It was basically a stopgap sort of activities that were being done in Asia, but institutionally there wasn't much interest. Even though the warnings of a rising China were clear at least 15 years ago, that any China that was going to have the potential to defeat us in a certain kind of shoot-up, yet there was very little interest in that. So, you know, I think it's, if it requires the Commandant to say, well, Asia gets priority, if that's the only way to get proper attention, well, fine. But at the same time, you know, we should be able to do all sorts of things. If we have to, you know, one part of that debate has always been, you know, should we do with counterinsurgency because we're a high-end fighting force?
Right.
I've always thought a military should be able to do all those things. And so geographically, I'd like to think the same thing, but you do have to see where your biggest threat and enemy is, and I think it definitely is China these days.
Give me your... being somebody from Northern Virginia, do you think Congress would allow the United States, I mean, the Marine Corps to be that nuanced? Because, you know, for instance, I can see the 3rd Marine Division, right, tilted, you know, to include, I mean, operating along the lines that the Commandant is the division. But I still think you need the 1st Marine Division to be the thunderous right hook, right? And I think you need the 2nd Marine Division to be kind of tilted towards Norway, you know, and Europe. And so to me, I don't know how... So to me, do you think that... Because if the Marine Corps can't do windows... then somebody else has to do windows because we don't any longer have a force that can fight two wars simultaneously. That's out of the picture. So everybody's got to play. So now if you don't do windows, how do I replicate that capability that you used to have and provide me in this theater and this theater and this theater and this theater? Do you think that Congress would allow the Marine Corps to become that specialized and tilted? What is your read as a native of... or a longtime dweller of Northern Virginia, which makes you a D.C. specialist, by the way.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's Congress of which you speak. Could you tell me who they are? No, oh, they...
please don't make me.
Yeah, you know, who knows what Congress thinks? I'm not sure that except at maybe the staff level on those congressmen or senators who really follow the stuff, that there's that much... thought given. I think the idea is, you know, just the military, you better be ready to do whatever you need. I'm not quite sure just that Congress is all that plugged in on the details of how the Marines will go about filling their role in national defense. But on a sort of related issue that you mentioned, my take is that with the 1st Marine Division or 1MEF and 3MEF, you know, which you know is a little bit smoke and mirrors the way forces are assigned to it.
Right.
that with that, you should be able to do an awful lot in the Pacific. Because 1 MEF has got a lot of people, 3 MEF, a lot less people, but you put everything they've got together. And if you use it right, you can do an awful lot there, and I would suggest that 2 MEF, or the East Coast guys, that they can do all sorts of things out to the east, and then you sort of jerry-rig things as necessary. But I don't know that, you know, we can't cover the range of sort of contingencies that were issues or challenges that we're facing. Just my sense of it. So I'm not, you know, that worried about our ability to do it, to do whatever we need anywhere. But it's often just a question of thinking clearly about what it is you want to do, where it is, why, what the big threats are, and then reorganizing what you already have and applying it in a sensible way, as opposed to all in the sandbox and nothing in Asia, or now all in Asia and nothing anywhere else. And I think we should be able to handle, say, the range of things going on in the world. It's just my sense of it.
Well, you almost dropped ROMO on me, didn't you?
What is ROMO?
Range of Military Operations. ROMO, come on.
Well, I wonder what Nathan Bedford Forrest would have called it in his clear English. Would have been, you mean you've got to do everything? Well, yeah, you know, do whatever you need to do. But I think we do have not inconsiderable resources, both numbers wise and hardware wise. If we go about it in a sensible way, and that's not always a given, in my opinion.
So your answer is God only knows what's going to happen?
Oh, kind of. I think if we keep our wits about us, that I think we can, let's say, handle everything that we need to do. Though it does require sort of assistance from the political side, the civilian side of the house, and even the just get the other the three ser- four ser- three or four services cooperating with each other, and that'll you find that will pay some dividends rather than just each trying to do their own thing and hope it somehow fits together nicely.
Right. No, well, you read stuff that says we're going to give away all our We're not going to have any tanks. We're not going to, we're going to give away this kind of tubed artillery. And those are things that you can't, you can't mobilize a reserve that has those things. Now, I could see if you want to take your tank battalions and move them to the reserve so you could do something else, but you still have that capability. You still have those supply pipelines. You still, you can still draw on that. But once it goes away and you don't have it, you fundamentally change the force in a way that you can't unchange it. So it's pretty interesting. I mean, I think his, in a lot of places, this is new. As you said, people get transfixed by bright, shiny objects, and then you start asking hard questions. Okay, well, got it, China. But why wouldn't we tilt the 3rd Marine Division? We have, battalions from the 1st and 2nd Division rotating out there on a constant basis, so that knowledge is spread throughout the Marine Corps. That, and you can tailor them to fight tonight, in wherever, if we're seizing, if we're seizing choke points, if we're seizing pieces of land for airstrips and comm relays and stuff like that, you can do all that. But does it mean the rest of the force needs to be configured like that too? And so I don't know. I haven't seen it. I haven't seen all the details because I don't think he's published them, but I just was curious about your thoughts.
Well, I would, I agree with you, what you said, and I hadn't heard about getting rid of artillery and tanks and the like. But that, if that is being seriously considered, I would imagine it's the same people who refuse to put in V-shaped hulls and armored vehicles for all those years. I don't understand why you give up a capability, like a tool that you may need. It's in the toolbox, and you just might need it somewhere. Why you give it up? They say as you're chasing the hot thing, and once going back to this insurgency fad, where the idea was, well, you'll never need whatever, sort of heavy art. You won't need artillery. You don't need armored tanks. For example, and that is, you rush into something else and you configure yourself just to deal with that, And if you do that, you can bet you're going to need the other stuff somewhere else. You know, you remember all when you joined the Marines, probably before I did, probably, but Vietnam was the thing. And it was all about fighting in a jungle in Southeast Asia. And then it got to be Iran. And then everything went from the jungles to the deserts.
Right.
And, you know, it always shifts to some other place.
And then we wouldn't even talk about Vietnam, right? I mean, the best boot that has ever been designed came out of Vietnam. That was a jungle boot. It had a great bottom on it not the Vibram bottom, but the kind of the spiked bottom one boot. And they dried out quick. They dried out quick, and your feet weren't soaking wet. But we wore leather, black, you know, LPCs, leather personnel carriers. They were awful. We wore woodland uniforms, hotter than shit, and we did that in the Pacific. And you couldn't wear a bush cover. And if you owned old utilities that were Vietnam era camouflage patterns, you got told to get rid of those. And so what you're saying is it seems to be the shiny object, not like, yeah, you know, we've all been over, you know, playing in the sandbox, but you know what? We're back home now, and our training's got to be, you know, come back and be balanced the last 6 months. If you're going back, you know, you will focus, you know, coordinate surge and all the different things that we do over there. You can do that. But, you know, we have to retain balance in the force. Interesting stuff. What about, let me ask you this, Grant. What does a fight in the Western Pacific look like?
Boy, it depends, like a lot of things. You know, there's it could be like a sort of naval forces slugging it out would be one way to do it. One difference, of course, is that with the weaponry today and long-range missiles, that you can really start hitting the other side effectively from much longer distances than...
Okay, let's talk about that. Let me take you down a road that I went down with the two local yokels here. The first thing that has to happen is everybody's satellites get fried. Okay? So everybody's eyes get poked out. No more satellites, right? No GPS doesn't work, right? In a peer-to-peer competition between the United States and China, that stuff gets fried electronically. That's gone. So now you have target acquisition problems. You can see to the extent of your radar, which changes the whole picture, you know. And if you light off radar, it can be seen. If it can be seen, it can be shot because, as you said, the modern lethality. So China is kind of geographically screwed, right? They've got, you know, a couple of different belts that hem them in. Why would we care about the Senkaku Islands, the Paracel Islands? I mean, who gives a shit? Those things would be vaporized or annihilated, and then we would blockade, in my opinion, I'm not a war planner, mind you, but we would hem them in to their coast with our allies, you know, the Straits of Malacca into the Indian Ocean, you know, with the Australians, the Japanese, and the Taiwanese. We would have them hemmed in. So... why would we press the fight inside that arc? Why wouldn't we just let them rot in their own shit? Mac, that's from Mac, Michael T. Mahan right there. So go ahead.
Okay, I think I slept through that class, that expression at Amphibious Warfare School, too. But actually I should have started rather than going right into the hardware, into the geography of it, which you properly did. Is if you consider sort of a fight or what's for the initial maneuverings that are either to a fight or to avoiding a fight, you always need to consider geography in Asia first. And China it does indeed face what you'd call the first island chain,
right,
stretching really from Japan down through the Philippines, through Taiwan, and down to Malaysia. Borneo. And that is, if you look at the map, that effective from China's perspective, you have these islands, these archipelagos, that really prevent their easy access eastward into the Pacific. And then there's even a second island chain that runs down from Japan to Guam, and then downwards to Indonesia, even Australia, depending on how you describe it. So geography does matter, and the Chinese are faced with the dilemma of having to break through these island chains. And while the Americans in the free world would tend to look at the first island chain and the second island chain as defensive positions to really defend those and prevent the other, present the other side with the difficulty of trying to break through. And it is, the geography being what it is, you can block the choke points that the Chinese would need for access using, you know, missiles, mines, submarines, aircraft, etc. So you it can be done. Actually, with a relatively sort of an economy of force, sort of to it all. But the one of the things to consider, but if there is, and as you said, it's not really worth us trying to take the fight into China.
Yeah, what's the point? What's the point?
Let them sit. But it's let them come into our kill zones, and take the casualties. It's much easier. Much easier to defend than it is to try to shoot your way in. Into Chinese defenses, and then to do what? But there is a sort of an instinct in certain quarters on our side to, you know, figure out how we're going to fight into China's so-called A2AD, anti-access area denial networks, and that's roughly akin to the British trying to figure out, the French trying to figure out in 1917 how they're going to get to the German lines in the Western Front and break through. It's possible, but at what cost?
Right.
You'd rather be on defense.
Right. As opposed to the German approach, in the second iteration of that, they had the Maginot Line, and they said, we'll just go around it. And the French at the time, the largest standing army in the world, you know, the great fortification of the Maginot Line, and the Germans went around it. What? And France fell in 6 weeks, right? It does beg the question. Now, I was told that, yeah, you Americans, you know, you got a few things wrong here. And I said, okay. And first of all, the Chinese have a much longer planning horizon, right? Because they're a totalitarian state, blah, 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 blah. And so so I read that on the air. I then got an email from somebody from Taiwan who lives in Canada, and is a expat from Taiwan. And they said that, what did he tell me? He said, look, I think they're under as much pressure to deliver to their totalitarian government. Dear Major McNamara, I am neither Marine nor an American, but I listened to your podcast with great interest recently, and it is great to hear that the defense community, I guess I'm included in that, I'm not sure I am, is aware of and is rising to the challenge of an increasingly belligerent China. On the other hand, as a Taiwanese Canadian who regularly keeps up on the local news and has many friends and family in the country of my birth, I felt the need to correct some comments made on your October 4th podcast. First of all, I can say there is no evidence of a growing reunification. Thank you for your clarity on the fact that the two were never unified to begin with. You taught me that, Grant. Movement. Taiwanese people as a whole are opposed to this unification with Taiwan. There is a small fringe group affiliated with organized crime groups who evidently get funding from Beijing as part of their united front warfare tactics, but they have little support from the general public, which views their politics and methods as distasteful. In fact, 80% of those surveys oppose unification, and that number has shown a steady increase over the years, as has the percentage of people who self-identify as Taiwanese as opposed to Chinese. Furthermore, 70% of Taiwanese polled would fight in the event of a Chinese invasion. This trend will no doubt accelerate as a result of events in Hong Kong and Xinjiang, as the youth who have grown up only knowing independence and democracy replace older generations. Now, this is what I thought was interesting. Secondly, and contrary to popular belief, the CCP leadership, mainly Chairman Xi, is not far-thinking and does not plan in centuries. They are human beings with all of the incumbent short-sightedness, faults, and frailties of being human. In charge of a cutthroat political system and an increasingly corrupt oligarchy, this leadership, obsessed with protecting their own ill-gotten personal gains or just preserving their lives, have surrounded themselves with people who will not provide critical feedback, and they are steering the ship with less and less understanding of the world as it is rather than how they would like it to be. If they were truly far-thinking, we would not see the way in which they have stifled economic reforms, feeding the economic bubble they have created, which will only implode in a far worse way down the road. We would also not see the hubris and desperate ham-fisted tactics alienating neighboring countries, enraging the people of Hong Kong, Xinjiang, and Taiwan, angering the U.S., or any other of the many ways China has shot itself in the foot rather than laying low and co-opting allies. I would venture to say that the leadership has no understanding or answer to its current problem and its flailing. I thought, and then he says this, thirdly, China does not have time on its side. With an aging population caused by its one-child policy and zero immigration, there is a looming demographic time bomb. By 2023, China's population is predicted to peak, and the elderly population will reach 400 million, about a third of the population by 2035, despite dubious reports of 6% GDP, analysis of consumer spending, energy consumption, import numbers, unemployment, and the number of failing banks and unpaid debt has indicated that the true number is closer to 2% GDP growth or less. On top of this, there's a problem of pollution, desertification, poison water, blah, blah, blah. China only has a limited time window to make gains before their demographic dividend dries up, but it's likely to grow old before it grows rich. So pretty interesting little email, huh, Grant?
Yeah, you have some guys who can read and write listening to your show, but it's a thoughtful commentary, and you know, here and there there's just a few tweaks that I might suggest. I think it's right on the money, and it's important that you know he gets to I think some of the real big things is that the Chinese Communist Party leadership doesn't have forever to get what they want. I think they are being squeezed by circumstances to grab Taiwan, get world dominance, whatever you want to call it, that they don't have a sort of unlimited timeline. And I think they do have to move. And some guys that I would listen to say within this decade, within the 2020s, that they're going to have to do something because of all these problems that the listener has very nicely laid out. And he's right that in that regime, those regimes are always sort of cutthroat operations. Being willing to kill or imprison your rivals only gets you so far for a certain period of time. That they're around Xi. That you know, it is possible. You do have who's going to tell Xi he doesn't know what he's doing? That he is surrounded in all likelihood, the way it works in these places, by yes men or people who want to keep the boss happy. And so he just might have people around him telling him, you know, this is your last chance. You've got to go. The military is so powerful now, and it won't last forever. Now's the time, and that is a real concern that a drunk talking himself into a fight. If he was sober, he wouldn't start. We may have a degree of this going on. One thing I would suggest in the characterization is that yes, while the Chinese Communist Party may not have play the so-called long game, which is what we always hear.
Right.
And I think that's true, but considering we play such a short game, which is like until the next election or shorter, that what they their perspective, their time frame is certainly longer than ours, and that I think is an advantage. Whereas we need immediate results. So that's one place I would differ, but otherwise I think it's a very thoughtful commentary that really covers the waterfront about a lot of things.
Interesting. No, interesting, as you said, very thoughtful. And again, you've been, you know, the person that has taught me the most relative to, you know, the Pacific Rim and the issues, there. And then, I mean, you see it play out, as you've educated us, you know, that with the way China behaves and I guess at reading that and listening to you, is it the end game in the South China Sea? Is it territorial, or is it economic, or is it both? What do you think is at the root of, because, you know, you hear this, hey, people believe that there is an absolute gold mine under the South China Sea, which is why you saw the Nine Dash Line, which is why you've seen the fortifications of the atolls and islands there. Do you have an opinion on that? Is it primarily economic? Is it both? Is it China just stretching and flexing its muscles as it becomes a more powerful nation?
I think it's, you know, more of the more from a strategic, a military perspective is the real motivation, and then that from operating from bases in the South China Sea, you're able to sort of exert influence and really attack another 1,000-1,500 miles farther out much more easily. At the same time, plus you've thrown your weight around, you've shown that you are the dominant force in Asia and that you're going to be listened to. It's a way of attracting attention to China's demand that every other country in this region is going to take China's interests into account and do what China says, or else. And so I think that's really the driving force. It allows you to reach out farther, and you know, you've established your footprint just way beyond your borders. Plus, I think getting more fish, getting potentially oil, if it's there, I think that's sort of a bonus. If a bully happens to, you know, take something and, like, steal somebody's jacket, and then he finds there's a $20 bill in the pocket, well, that's just, you know, nice. But I think the economic part is secondary. Plus, you have, if you've got the South China Sea with the sea lanes that go through there, you're suddenly in a position to squeeze off Japan, your main rival in Asia. Just by threatening to choke off sort of trade and oil and going to from Japan, and so there's lots of benefits, economic, political, that come of improving your military position by grabbing the South China Sea. So I think that's what's behind it. Not that's one sometimes hear that China needs more fish and wants the oil that they think might be under the South China Sea. It's my sense. There's a main reason. I think if there was no fish, no oil in the South China Sea, they'd have done the same thing. Is my sense of it.
Interesting. Now, I posed. I didn't mean to, but you've written a piece entitled "USMC Commandant's Guidance Turns from Sandbox to Asia." Is there anything that is in that article that we have yet to discuss?
I don't know if we want to go into it, but just because it'd probably take an hour or two. But the article does cover the U.S. Army's the schizophrenia and effort to displace the Marine Corps in Asia. And that's been going on since at least 2000 that I know of. And that is part of the equation, and we haven't discussed that. The other part that, you know, I sort of pulled punches a little bit is that I think the Marine Corps and its ability to move around, be so-called expeditionary, but to move around easily, go places and sort of establish itself is perfectly suited for the Asia-Pacific region. And I remember this was probably 6 or 7 years ago. I was involved in a war game that was actually very well done. They played it fair. And I remember suggesting to the somebody or other that, well, let's, you know, put Marine units down here on these islands in Southeast Asia area, and just, you know, they put them there with their anti-ship missiles. And they said, well, the Marines don't have anti-ship missiles. And it never crossed my mind that this wouldn't be part of the menu or the toolbox for a MEU, because it's a perfect weapon, and we didn't even have them. And the fact that the Marines did not have an anti-ship missile in the inventory was just astonishing, you know, given that we've certainly have been aware of Asia for a long time and aware of how where the threat is coming from and how you would fight it. And to not have that would be like finding you don't have machine guns, you know. And so this really is, a lack of foresight on the some part. You know, it's not leprechauns who are to blame, but at some point in our institution, somebody really dropped the ball. And you know, just now, where there's it looks as though they're going to acquire some anti-ship missiles, but you know, this was just a missing piece of the puzzle that. Really surprised me, and I think it does come of really this lack of attention to Asia, to the Pacific, and what is going to come here. And one might even say it was probably typified by, I think it was around 2008 when General Conway, the then commandant, visited the Chinese Marine Corps, and he gave them a pep talk basically saying, boys, try hard and master your trade. Something along those lines, and you know, the Marines and the visiting Marines and the Chinese Marines, they all did, you know, push-up competitions or whatever. And it is sort of love fest, which at that time it was obvious that China was an enemy, that what their objective was, and yet you had the commandant going and glad-handing with them and also giving them a pep talk of all things. And that was 2008, so whatever that is, 11 years ago. And here we are, but I do mention it briefly in the article, this at lack of anti-ship missiles, but I think that is symptomatic the Marines having really missed an upcoming threat that they should have done a much better job anticipating.
Does that go back though to your shiny object theory that, you know, we're all in one or the other and not, you know, this balanced basket of, okay, well, you know, if we have to fight tonight in the Pacific, you know, what are we going to be doing? We're going to, you know, we're certainly not going ashore, right? We're not storming, you know, the beaches of an area of the coastline of China, right? We're not storming those beaches. So where is the fight? What do we do? How are we tailored to do that? And so, you know, now we've pulled back on 38 amphibs as a party platform. Okay, so are we already there? How do we get there? How do we fight tonight? You know, how do we do it? And it's pretty stunning. Like, okay, look, we're not going to have anti-ship missiles. Where do they come from? Are they going to come off aviation platforms? So, you know, we're not gonna be in a position to shoot those. I mean, is it just another munition that we can, you know, that we can buy and shoot from, you know, our missile launchers, our glimmers, and all the rest of that stuff?
We do have HIMARS, which can be, I think, put into an anti-ship mode. But you do want a more traditional anti-ship missile. That you just go to Norway with a credit card to the Kongsberg company and you can buy any number of them you wanted. But I think it does go to that shiny object sort of phenomenon that we've mentioned. But I would note that there's always been within the Marine Corps, there's always been these pockets of people who were thinking about these things, who knew what needed to be done. And I remember at Marfor Pack there were such people. Quantico has these little rooms here and there. Yeah, there are people who do this, and I think that's where the commandant got his ideas. I doubt that he thought them up, but he was wise enough to listen to some of these people who've been thinking. So we've always had these thinkers, but they are sort of holding the fort until the larger organization wakes up. But then we do tend to, say, rush into sort of whatever the hot thing is. So, you know, that the one way to look at how you might employ all these things in Asia is, once again, look at the map and look at where you could block off sort of choke points or sort of access points for the Chinese into sort of eastward into the Pacific. And it's really the same problem that, you know, not that different than taking on the Japanese in World War II, but one way to consider employment of the, it's a very loose analogy of right. Marines, right. One way, is if you think of the Coast Watchers in World War II, that right. the Australians right. put them together and placed them on islands down in the South Pacific, right. to the Southwest Pacific. And they would watch for Japanese ships and aircraft coming through and give advance notice to the Marines or the Americans on the other end, so they'd be ready for this. And supposed, and all that all they were doing was get, was providing notice. But what if they had had anti-ship missiles with them, or the right sort of anti-aircraft weaponry and even smart mines like you have today? That they could have made life even more miserable for the Japanese headed down to Guadalcanal.
Well, and you know, when you think of that, Grant, I mean, you know, remember the old, you know, coastal artillery batteries that if you go down to San Diego, down to Point Loma, you see, you know, Battery Ashburn, I think it is, and they're still there. You can go, I think, on certain times of the year, you can go into them. And there are these cavernous, right, gigantic coastal artillery fortifications. Well, imagine if those had missiles on them now, today. I mean, just think about, so, you know, to kind of illustrate Grant's point, like those things were, you know, ships show on the horizon, we have these big guns, we try to shoot them at max distance, blah, 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 before they can range us. And that's what they did. Well, imagine if you'd had something that could literally reach out from those same key strategic places, and it's already there. So you fight today, we could fight right now. We don't have to fight tonight. You want to fight? We could fight right now. So those are interesting questions. Now, I guess my question is, who is responsible for anti-ship missiles? Is that a Navy responsibility? Is that a Marine Corps? As we do the National Defense Strategy and different branches are assigned different tasks, who owns that? And, you know, and I think the Marine response would be, well, that's an aviation thing. Right, that's an aviation thing, and we're not going to worry about a ship closing on our Marines, because that will never happen. And if that's happening, that means that our aviation assets have been either destroyed, and that means it's time to smile and wave, boys. It's time to go home. So it's kind of again, I don't know enough about that particular issue in terms of procurement responsibility and whatnot. What do they call it? If you're like the lead, right? Well, you'd be the lead service in development of XYZ, I guess I'm saying. Who's lead in developing anti-ship missiles? I would assume the Navy. Who's charged with it? And because, you know, and might it be another munition like we shoot, you know, all the time from, you know, guided missile pods now all over the world? So I don't know enough. I should probably educate myself on that, because it's an interesting question.
Yeah, it would be for ground launched anti-ship missiles. I think that the Army is far, far ahead of us. Though we say we've got our HIMARS systems are adaptable.
So tell me how the Army, explain to me what the Army's doing in the Pacific, and, you know, where are they doing it from? Are they doing it from Fort Lewis? I mean, are they doing it from Hawaii? Are they doing it from Korea? Where are they becoming expeditionary from?
In their minds, but they are, I think USARPAC is the sort of the it seems to be the source of these ideas, and the idea is to make themselves more expeditionary, rotate through the region in relatively small units. and do operation, you know, do operations there, which kind of sounds like a Marine Corps. The word going back, just leaving that issue aside of they're trying to displace us, whereas they might have a different core competency, and they might also want to consider their splendid success in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Hey, no need to army hate. But I mean, the bottom line is we need them out there, so they've got to get out there, and they've got to flex their muscles. They got to get their feet in underneath them. They got to figure out how they're going to get there, because you know the Marine Corps not going to fight that fight on its own.
That's right. You know, the Army definitely has a place out there and an important role. And in fact, in this sort of anti-ship missile or the long-range rocket capability there, they are, I think, they're the leaders in it for us. And to have them fit in sort of to a sort of a comprehensive, coherent defense is exactly what you want. But it really gets down to a willingness to cooperate and say, how can we fit in rather than it's our show because we're the Army. It sounds so just crazy to have to argue about this thing rather than, and you can get a long way when you find that different group, when people cooperate with each other. And that's where one of my beefs is. That it's an effort to dominate and say, I'm in charge now, you'll do what I say.
You sound like one of those like one of those paranoid chowder society guys.
Oh, well, I call it what you want, but if it was reversed, if it was the Marines saying, well, we're going to, you know, we need 2,000 tanks and we're going to be the guys who are going to just...
That would never happen. Come on, don't be crazy.
But if we did, then I would be going after us even more. But it is this childishness that I saw on display. I had at least a second row seat to seeing it a few years ago, and it was a huge distraction at the time China was seizing the South China Sea. But that said, the army are the leaders in the sort of the long range rocket and anti ship missile capability, and that's one where they could really play a useful role, and that's where I think they ought to be focusing their efforts. Diverted onto this.
I think I diverted you. Let me ask you a communications question. Since you're so smart, if the premise of this discussion is that everybody's eyes get poked out, at least long range eyes, satellites get poked out, stuff like that. That those things all get degraded. It then becomes a target acquisition fight. You know, we have a lot more aircraft carriers should the fight take place in the next 15 years. And that's really what got that email exchange going. Oh, the fight won't take place in the next 15 years. China knows it can't do that. So it won't. It will seek to win in other ways. And then, you know, somebody, you know, wrote that in, and then the guy from Canada responded like, no, they don't have unlimited amount of time on the throne. So assuming that it is this a target acquisition fight, do you have a sense of what the fight looks like if it ever came to shooting in the South China Sea, in the South China Sea?
Boy, if it did, I would prefer to watch it from Bermuda. I think it's sort of one way to say it. I think it came into a in the South China Sea.
Hold on. I can't hear you very well now. You sound muffled.
Okay, so I think if it did come, you know, into a fight in the South China Sea, that we would really be in a lot of trouble just from their long-range precision weapons. You'd have anti-ship missiles and rockets just whizzing, but well, you'd like them to whiz by because that might mean they missed, but we would just suffer a lot of casualties. Even if you move farther out into the Pacific, I have a feeling that we would have some trouble, not least the Chinese anti-ship missiles outrange our naval missile, the naval equivalent, by 50 miles at least, as I understand it. And that's a problem. Chinese submarines and anti-submarine warfare is getting better. So it's more of an even match. And some people would say that in certain areas, the Chinese even have an advantage. So regardless of who prevails, and we just might, we're going to have to get used to the idea of losing 5,000 people in an afternoon. And that would be, I would suggest, a shock to the system. But one thing I would throw out, because we do talk a lot about what happens in a shoot-up. One would know that it wouldn't be good. But the one thing that needs a lot of attention is what happens in the so-called day zero, before the shooting starts. Right. And that's where the political warfare, the Chinese efforts at subversion, are so important and have been pretty effective, where we've talked about it before. We used to consider the Philippines as an area from which we could defend pretty freely, and not so much now with President Duterte in the Philippines, who's at best on the fence and is at worst pro-China, so it's not easy for us to operate there. Taiwan, that's at risk, and so you lose that, and that's some military geography you'd like to have. Thailand has shifted the other way. So we haven't really done so well on laying the political groundwork to allow us to really implement the strategy the commandant is talking about. And that should be a very serious concern, because the commandant says, well, we're going to get dispersed ourselves throughout the geography of the region or something like that. Well, okay, fine. Where are you going to put yourself if the politics aren't there?
Right.
And that's one thing that needs a lot of attention. And just the other day, the Solomon Islands signed a deal with the Chinese, basically leasing the island of Tulagi, which, if anyone remembers, is the part of the Guadalcanal campaign. And it's
ouch.
A very good...
Ouch, that hurts.
It does, and you look at the map, so they've kind of leapfrogged the first and second island chains, if they can bring it to fruition and things play out in the worst way for us. But so you can see how it's that phase zero, jockeying for position, which really is key to a lot of things, and the military has a role to play. But once again, our civilian, the State Department, Department of Defense, and even the American business community, to the extent it can be harnessed, they all have a role in ensuring our phase zero position, and also getting our partners involved in it in some sort of coordinated way, the Australians, the Japanese, etc. So the phase zero is, I would suggest, as important as when the shooting starts. And if you get phase zero right, you may not have shooting because the other side can't move. But just as easily, we could find ourselves in a position where we can't move.
I disagree. How do we get in a position where we can't move? Because, it's kind of an interesting little intellectual jaunt I went on, Grant, but I'm looking at China geographically, and so one of the skills I learned as a lieutenant captain was, all right, when you're trying to do an estimate of the situation, turn the map around, you be him, assume that he's a smart guy like you are, assume he doesn't want to die, is not going to do stupid things, what would you do? And so you look at the problem of China's geography, and then I looked at the United States. The United States, there is no planet, there's no nation on the planet that has a greater piece of real estate than the United States of America. And to me, this is going to sound corny and American, but this incredible intellectual experiment in democracy lands on a piece of real estate that can support its security. It's really amazing. It's really amazing. Those two big oceans, friendly neighbors to the north and south, right? And, boom. So it's really interesting that this intellectual experiment lands on this incredible piece of real estate on the planet. I don't know how you navigate those lines of communication with large forces to threaten us. I mean, you have to have a lot of shit. I don't know that anybody has anything close to that. You could screw with us a little bit, but I think the whole naval warfare, it's going to go drones and missiles. And you know, you're going to have a mothership, and then you're going to have all these little drones out there pinging their ass off. Bing, bing! We used to, you know what, the P-3 Orion, the danger of the P-3 is the sonobuoy. It can ping, nobody cares, and it's if you're in the region, it'll find you. And now you're going to have little drone things, drops swimming around everywhere, pinging their ass off. And if you're in the region, you're going to be located, and then you're going to be destroyed. And so I think you're going to see the same thing go on in the sky. You're going to have an F-35 that controls, you know, a whole series of, not F-35s, but a series of drones. And so I think... I don't know. We're going to have robot wars, and it'll be interesting. Anyway, your thoughts on that?
Well, I think you're basically you know, sometimes I feel like one of these horse cavalry guys in about 1935. But I'm smart enough to know it's changing. And along the lines you said, with just consider and use a little imagination about what you can do with drones, unmanned vehicles, smart sea mines.
Right.
I think it's going to be very, very different just in 20 years. I think we might hardly even recognize some of the hardware that's being used. I think the same basic idea of killing other humans, that won't change much. But the hardware is really going to change. There's a fellow named, I don't know if you know him, Colonel, he's retired, Colonel T.X. Hammis.
Yeah, you bet.
Who's always been very thoughtful about this. Some would say iconoclastic. But he makes an awfully good case of some of the changes that are coming along the lines you've described.
Well, and then throw artificial intelligence in all of that.
Yeah.
And who owns the high ground?
And that's where I could see us getting put in a position we can't move. If you lose the so-called 5G, the high-tech, the weaponization of high-tech, that if you don't control that or dominate, that and the other side does, you can find yourself operating on the defensive, which is a real problem. And then the so-called A2AD weaponry, you know, that's, you know, going back to could the Chinese put us in a position we can't move, you know, at an acceptable cost. Now, that's where I think if they get themselves positioned right with enough stuff to be able to really make it us unable to move through an area without suffering heavy casualties, unless we can come up with some other way to get through with other things, and that's where this next generation sort of high-tech weapons comes in, or something that can remove or eliminate their long-range precision weapon advantage. Say lasers and energy weapons come immediately to mind.
The thing that neutralizes all of that, though, Grant, is when you take away their ability to acquire targets. Then, to me, they have this incredible capability that's long range. You got it. How do they acquire the target once they don't have satellites up there?
But what if they can do that to us first? And I think, and they've been trying to get that right for a long time.
Right.
So I always hope we have these rooms somewhere with these really smart guys thinking up stuff. I don't know how else to put it, but you know, we've always been blessed to have. You know, these kind of impressive things that come into the open when we need them. And I hope we've got some things up our sleeves that will help out.
The I'm curious if I started to ask this question a bit ago, if we can replicate our calm, we can replicate lower orbiting satellites that we can protect. I don't know anything about calm architecture, but I would imagine that as you wargame this stuff, right? Okay, everybody's satellite gets zapped, you know, then how do we replicate this critical capability we have? Because once we lose our ability to, you know, to do combined arms, once we lose our ability to acquire targets, now are we going to go back to fighting in the Pacific like we fought in World War II? I don't know enough about that part of this fight, and I think that's pretty interesting. So anyway, but I've kept you very long. What are you riding next, and when will we see it, and where will we see it? Oh man, of many pens.
Well, I haven't, couple things, and I haven't quite decided, when or where, but the one thing about the, Chinese launching, what they call a Type, 075 amphibious ship, which is like our WASP class.
Right.
They just launched one month or two ago, and it was about 6 months from keel laying to getting in the water, whereas it appears to take us 3 years to do that. And they've got a couple more coming. And my point is that before long, there's going to be Chinese new ARGs making the rounds in Asia and beyond. And that's one of the pieces. And the other one's about Taiwan. And what I try to get across is that in the U.S. Congress, Republicans and Democrats from the extremes of both parties and everything in between are actually in supporting Taiwan, and they have actually since 2016 have specifically called for Taiwan's military to be included in exercises with the American forces, and yet nothing happens. And that's the point of the piece, is why is it that despite the representatives of the American people almost unanimously calling for DOD and the U.S. government to do something for Taiwan, nothing happens. And the point is there's a choke point within the U.S. government that is making sure nothing happens.
Where is that choke point? Are you going to go deep state on me right now?
Well, the State Department's been doing it for years, but DOD has also not exactly fought tooth and nail to overcome State Department. And then there's probably a few other places that deserve mention and may get mention in the piece. So that's what those two things I'm sort of working on.
Got it. All right, sir. First of all, travel safe. Enjoy your time in Australia. I've never been there. And where does Australia rank on your vacation sites in the Pacific?
Oh, I would think definitely it'd be pretty high. It's like going to Jersey. But no, it isn't. Nothing's as good as going to Jersey. But it ought to be high. You know, Sydney's one of these cities like Boston and San Francisco, kind of a mix, of it. So it's quite a striking place with a lot of old buildings, which I like. And then once you get out into the countryside, it's Australia's as big as us, and a lot of it is, if not desert, at least kind of like desert. But it's really a lot of coastline. It's an attractive place. And so it ought to be pretty high up there on people's lists, you know, if they want to come to Asia.
What is your number one place that you would tell them to go?
Probably, if you want to see something Asian-y, I would suggest Bali.
Bali,
yes. But you would have to make an effort to get out of the heavily touristed parts. But Bali has some places has a very sort of exotic Southeast Asia feel to it. Penang up in Malaysia is nice, particularly the old Chinatown. Getting up into the mountains in Malaysia is also very nice. Those would be sort of a couple places that immediately come to mind. There's probably a dozen others with a little thought, but those would be some places. If I had to pick three with a gun pointed to my head, that's probably what they would be.
All right. Well, look, travel safe, Grant. Thank you as always for the visit, and all the best.
Sure, pleasure. Okay, thank you. Bye-bye.
There you have it, Grant Newsham. More of All Marine Radio coming up next right here on your home for it, the one and only All Warrior Radio Network. That'll do it on a Wednesday.
Yeah, if you're just tuning in, don't touch that dial. Because in the first hour, we're going to talk about a little bit about Syria. We're going to talk about an update on an awesome story, which is the first successful full genital replacement ever done, and an update from the patient after a year and a half. And he said it's the best decision I ever made. So I can't tell you, I mean, how happy that makes me, because, you know, you saw guys injured like that, and, you know, you're it's crushing, you know, to think that at the age of 20 or 21 that, you know, you'll never have sex. I should say you'll never have sex, but, you know, the way we'd normally approach sex is not going to be in your future at such a young age. And so to think that the doctors, the nurses, the researchers at Johns Hopkins pulled that off and did it for free is amazing. It's absolutely amazing. The plastic surgeons, all that. It's absolutely, positively amazing. So just an awesome story. So we talked about that. Talk about Syria, talk about the Houston Astros beat the Yankees in a great walk-off game on Saturday night. And as a Yankee fan, I mean, I was sad my team lost a little bit, but it was such a great game. The drama is unbelievable. You'll hear some audio from that. And then the other thing I talk about is, before we get to news headlines, is trying to articulate this conversion from trauma to joy, right? In a visual way that people can understand it, right? And so you'll hear me talk about that too. So don't touch that dial. More of All Marine Radio coming up next, right here on your home for it, the one and only All Warrior Radio Network.